the other perspective, this is sort of, if you want to use terms for this, what I just said is referred to by some as the new perspective on Paul. And sort of what, if I end up continuing to do studies and go on to PhD studies, this is like the main area that I've written and worked in, is that what we call in the new perspective on Paul is, if you look in the early church, is actually sort of what the early church is saying. So we're calling something this NT Wright thing, this new perspective on Paul. This actually seems as though this is what the early church has been saying all along, but because we're pretty disconnected from them, we don't really recognize it. What the old perspective on Paul is, and when we're saying old, we're referring to 16th century, so this is what Luther and Calvin are getting out of this. Their understanding is that when Paul says works, he is referring to, you can say, any act of the human will. So anything that a person does, anything at all, that fits kind of works of the law. That's what works of the law are. On the other side of that is, you know, is faith. And so you have you have these works of the law, which is really anything. Anything can fit that. Paul's talking about circumcision here. We could be talking about anything. On the other side, you have faith. And faith is viewed, you could say, in a more passive sense, and not as much in an active sense. And so because of that, because there's this any act of the human effort, anything that you do, versus faith, which is a passive thing, and faith is being viewed as something that only God can give, well, you know, we can't do that on our own because we have this. This gets into other areas, but this is kind of where sort of total depravity, stuff like that, comes in. Because of that, that's where you get this really strong doctrine of election in both Luther and Calvin. And so for both of them, you know, whoever is going to be saved, God has chosen that far in advance, and there's not really a whole lot you can do about that. He has chosen these things from eternity, and what you're seeing right now is the outworking of his decree. You're seeing the outworking of what he chose before him. Now, this has been a huge area within Protestantism that we've struggled with. Because, I mean, you see this, and everybody knows this in Calvin. It's kind of, when you say Calvinism, that's usually what people are thinking of. It's like, you know, double predestination. The idea that God chose some people from the foundation of the world that he wanted to be in heaven with them. He chose other people that he didn't want to be in heaven with him, i.e. to be in hell. And what you're seeing now, everything that you're seeing around you, is the outworking of this decree that God made from eternity. For most of us, I'm guessing most of us at this table, maybe not this guy, I don't know, most of this table, that seems pretty weird. And there's, you know, I think that we get to spots where we want to hold that together with the rest of Scripture, and we have challenges in doing that. And so, if we're going to look at sort of the history of, you know, in Protestantism, I think it's fair to say that most Protestants haven't really held to this very strongly. And if you're looking at within evangelicals and evangelicalism, evangelicals by and large ignore this completely. Like, we actually think, yeah, yeah, we if it's not necessarily saying that predestination isn't there, because that's something where I think it's something that's scriptural, but saying that interpretation of what predestination is not something that we identify with.
Is there any other interpretation? It seems to be straightforward to me.
What Luther and Calvin are saying there?
Predestination being, you know, God chose some people to be happy, yeah, some people not.
Yeah.
Is there any other way to say
that? No, totally. Totally. It's a great question. I think if we're coming from a background where that's sort of taught as like, no, this is what this text means, then there can just sort of be this sort of assumption, well, that's what it is, and that's kind of all what it comes down to. And I think there's difficulties in working that out with the rest of Scripture. And some people just say, well, you have to live with those tensions, and that's okay. For the majority of Christian history, you can say, we'll trace this. So if we're looking in the earliest church, you have this really strong emphasis on free will, on the existence of free will, of something that, if you don't have free will, then what Scripture says doesn't make any sense. It's difficult to see how... It's just difficult to see how it holds together. And so, from the earliest church onwards, you have this strong emphasis. You also have this... You know, you have election language that's held together quite, you know, quite closely with it. But the way that the election language works is this, is that God has chosen us for this purpose. But Christ said that to he whom much is given, much will be required. And so we, on one hand, we've been chosen. This is something that hasn't come of our own. We haven't said, hey, I really want to go find God. And then, hey, we found him. We brought him down from heaven. And we did it. It's like, hey, go us. You don't see that. You see that God has chosen us. But what that means is that we are going to be judged more strictly than anybody else is. And so we need to live in light of that. It's kind of like, I mean, if you want to look at an analogy, you can see what James says about teachers James 4? You know, James 4, brothers, let not many of you become teachers, because you know that we will receive a stricter judgment. So it's kind of the, you know, it's sort of that general principle that's there. So we're going through early church history, So 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century, 4th century. And as we get to sort of the, as we get to kind of the, right between the 4th and 5th century, you find in St. Augustine, he's having sort of this argument with this group called the Pelagians. And the Pelagians are essentially, they're overemphasizing sort of our role in salvation, and they're underemphasizing the role of God's grace. And so that's a way that you can understand it. What Augustine does is he gets to a point where he eventually, so the reading that we have of predestination, instead of being selected from, like, for a particular purpose, it's something where it becomes sort of what we know it more commonly as. Because when Luther and Calvin are drawing, the church father that they draw upon more than anybody else is Augustine. In particular, these later works of Augustine. There's a lot that you see in the earlier works of Augustine that would undermine a lot of what both Luther and Calvin would want to do. In the later works of Augustine, you have this emphasis on predestination. And at the time, it's something where it causes a lot of, you can say, discomfort within the church, because basically what it says, look, you're Augustine, and you're sort of the biggest thing that's going around right now, because he really is. He is the guy is a genius, and theologically, he's kind of like Mount Everest. It's like you can't ignore it. There's a lot of stature that's there. At the same time, there's a lot of people that point out, so. There's another saint, Saint John Cassian, who goes and points out and says, look, what you're saying at this point is in discontinuity with what the church has held to over the past, you know, 400 years. And that's something that we're not comfortable with. And so you have at that point some, kind of what the church as a whole does, is it affirms certain parts of it and says, look, you have to have grace come before you to be saved. You have to have all this kind of stuff. And there is a role of God in selecting. It's not just we work our way up to him. He comes down. His grace is invasive. At the same time, it goes and sort of sidesteps other parts of his theology. So, for instance, there's a this this is getting into some sort of deeper theology stuff. But you have if you're reading in Calvin, for instance, if you're reading the Institutes. There's, I think it's in 1 Timothy, 2 Timothy, something like that. There's a spot where it says, God desires that all men should be saved. And for the early church, it's pretty clear what this means. It means that God desires for all men to be saved. It's like, that's what his desire is. What Calvin does is he says, well, we need to be careful with this, because that's not actually what the text means. What the text means is that God desires, when he says all men, he means like sort of one of each kind at least. So some of each kind. And so you can say when God desires all men to be saved, he desires all kinds of men to be saved. So he desires, there's some black people that he needs to be saved. You know, he desires some of those. But there's others that he doesn't. And we just need to affirm that. He doesn't want all people to be saved. He wants those people to be saved who he has chosen from eternity. and he chose some of all kinds, and that's just the way it works. And so if we say he wants all people, as in everybody, to be saved, we are we're basically going against who God actually is and what he says.
That's,
we can't
like
say that.
A misreading of the text, though.
Well, it's interesting. If you identify closely with the Reformed tradition, that's our heritage. And that's something that cuts to my heart, because, you know, that's I mean, I haven't come from like strongly Reformed traditions, but those are, most of the church background that I have is some flavor of Protestantism. And that exegesis is fundamental to at least to early Reformation theology. It ends up going in all kinds of directions following. And if you want to say, hey, what is Protestant theology in general? Good luck trying to define that, because it's like Baskin Robbins on steroids. Baskin Robbins has 31 flavors. This has like 3,031,000 flavors. Like you know, there's all kinds of stuff that's there. Anyway, what Calvin's doing there, we might say, hey, Calvin, like, you just invented that. Don't be a big jerk. What Calvin's actually doing there is he is jumping on the late works of Augustine, because that reading of that text came from Augustine. That comes in the late 4th century or the early 5th century. And that comes from his debates with the Pelagians. And he eventually says, you know, in trying to preserve the work of God's grace, he gets to a point where he says, well, this is what it has to mean. It has to mean that, you know, God took this. Now, the church at that time, some people in this context will say the Catholic Church of the time. I don't want to use that term, because if we say Catholic Church, we hear that through post-Reformation categories. And so we think, oh, this is sort of one branch of the church and this other branch of the church. This is just the unified church. So East, West, this is just the unified church. So we'll just say the church, because I don't want to give us the wrong impression. The church at the time doesn't identify with that. They say, we don't really know what to do with that. And so we're going to affirm what we can of this, but there's certain pieces that we're going to leave behind and not say are orthodox. So in the West, you know, they say there's parts of this that are cool, but there's parts of this that go beyond what the church has been given. And so we're not, you know, you're Augustine, we still think you're cool, but we're not going to codify what you're saying here as orthodoxy. The Eastern Church, on the whole, doesn't have any idea what to do with Augustine. Like, Augustine has been, by and large, like a mystery to them. They just don't understand him. And so what Albert will often do is he'll appeal to Eastern fathers, because I think that Albert sees a lot of these same problems in Augustine's stuff, and he sees kind of how these get worked out. And so Albert will just go, I'm like, hey, let's talk about Gregory of Nyssa, who's an Eastern father. And because the Eastern Church, this doesn't make a whole lot of sense to them. So that's some backstory. As far as what predestination is actually meaning, so you have that context of, like, what we're just talking about is of being selected by God, but being selected for a purpose and one for which you are accountable. I think that if you want to get deeper into predestination stuff, the view of most of Christian history has been that God is choosing based off of his foreknowledge. And so when it says he is predestining something, he's predestining something in the sense that he stands outside of time. So you can think of a clock. Let's just picture like a clock in your head. And we are stuck in this clock. We're going around in the clock because we're in this. This is the context that we exist in. We exist in time. Well, God doesn't exist in time in the same way. He's not bound by time. There's not a category that we can put on God and say, hey, you are bound by this thing. God can enter time. He can work through what he's put in us, but he's not bound by it. He's not stuck inside of a clock. And so because of that, he has foreknowledge of what is going to happen. That's something that he can use. And so he is able to simultaneously give us free will. He is able to simultaneously give us real opportunities to choose, and then at the same time stand outside of that clock and say, yeah, because I'm not in that clock, I can see what you chose, even though you haven't chosen it yet. I can see what happened. And so I'm already making moves based, it's almost like you can think of a poor analogy is a chess player who sees what your moves are going to be about five moves before you make them, and is already making moves in his head based off of those moves because he has foreknowledge of what you're going to do. A really good chess player is like that, and a really good chess player is a poor analogy, but still, I think, somewhat of an analogy to what God is like with us. He just stands outside of time. He stands outside of that, so he is able to go through and anticipate those kinds of things.
So not that he's making the decision for you, he just looks ahead and sees your decision
exactly.
And works around it.
Exactly.
So we do, by and large, have free will.
Exactly.
He just works around our choice.
Exactly.
That's how exactly is that free will? Because, I mean, the fact is, if God is omnipotent, as it's been said throughout the Bible, then he has the choice whether or not to change our actions or affect them as they happen in the future.
Yeah.
So, in that sense, our actions are only what God has allowed us to do.
Yeah.
And so, in a sense, they are our actions, but they're the actions that God has led us to.
Yeah, I think that's actually a pretty fair way to look at it. I think that one of the, and maybe a helpful way to look at it is to go back to the image of God, because this is something where, for instance, if you read Gregory of Nyssa, this is one of the things that he'll come back to a lot when he's talking about freedom and free will. He'll come back to the image of God and say, this as much as anything else is fundamental to what it is to be created in the image of God, is to have this free will, to have this degree of freedom to choose one thing or to choose another thing. Because we have that image, because we have made us, because God has made us in our image, we have that. Now that image is something that's tarnished by sin, and so we don't. I think that if somebody is going to say, oh, everybody has free will to kind of do whatever they want and just sort of stuff like that, I'm probably going to start leaning over to Augustine and saying, you might not understand the gravity of what sin is. You might not understand the degree to which sin impedes with everything and does tarnish everything. But at the same time, even for the person who is most tarnished by sin, who in their own bodies have gotten completely worked into the most gnarly of patterns, even for that person, I don't think that God ever takes away at least the will or the ability to go and to cry out to him. I think that that's sort of the fundamental thing that's there. And so when you say that all who call on the Lord will be saved, I think that that ability to cry out to God and say, God, my will is not free right now. My will is tarnished by all kinds of crap, and I can't get myself out of this. But you can help me. You can give me grace. You can bring me out of this and do what I can't do for myself. I think at that point, that's something that I think remains. And I think that where Luther and Calvin, particularly Calvin, just because he puts more emphasis on this, I think that Calvin negates that. I just think it's problematic. I think that it's in discontinuity with the broader Christian tradition. I think that there's a lot of scriptures that are difficult to hold in tension with that perspective. But you can say that even us having free will is something that we only had because God is sovereign. It doesn't undermine God's sovereignty to say that we have a degree of free will if what God sovereignly says is, hey, I want you guys to have some freedom on this. I want you guys to be able to participate in my image. Does that make some sense?
But the thing is, I don't understand how exactly we're participating, because everything we do is more like, more or less than the framework of what he's like set up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my definition of free will is wrong, but I mean, free will would be not having a path set up for us, and being able to pick a choice and affecting our lives in that way. Rather, what we're doing is we're picking the path that God already knows we're going to pick, and we're picking that path because of the things that He set up for us to do in the past.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we are who we are because of our experiences, the experiences that God set up for us.
Yeah.
And we make decisions based on those past experiences that, again, God set up for us.
Yeah.
And so in that sense, it's not us that are really making it, but us making it because of what God has made us go through.
The thing that I think is dangerous about that is because then you all of a sudden point that towards people who are doing awful things in the world, and you go, that was God's path for them. They chose that path. And if God predestined someone to do anything that would be wrong or considered evil or even at all sinful, then we wouldn't have the same God that we have today. Because God can't do anything that is wrong. That is absolutely against the very definition of who God is.
Then how would you rationalize that?
What do you mean?
Like, how would you make it, I mean, how would you explain it then? Like,
no, I think what you're saying is
God not part of that.
As in, God has an option for people. The reason God came down was to give people the way out. To give people the option and the ability to choose him over the rest of the crap that's already in the world. So, like, this is how Albert Isaacs explained this to me. Like, God is, like, kind of come in and given people a path. And he goes, look, I have, and when he's saying I've predestined something for you, he's like going, like, look, I have this perfect path. And I have a path for you, and you can keep choosing it. But as soon as you walk away from that in different ways, and it's really easy to walk away from it. It's not like it's like a straight line that we're having to walk on a tightrope. But like, people can choose to not choose God. Like, dude, I could choose to walk away from God right now, and it wouldn't be God's will for my life. That wouldn't be God's will for my life. I know that.
Yeah.
I could choose to go and like stab someone right now, and that would not be God's will for my life. I know that. That's against God's will for my life.
I get what he's saying in that, like, and because I think of it the same way. Like, God is like, all right, so there's this path that I have set out for you.
Yeah.
But there's also like a million other ones that like may not be in my will, but you can choose this one that I have for you. But at the same time, if like, you know, from what you guys have been saying, like, and I'm thinking of this from his perspective, and you know, I'm wondering the same things as well. And it's like, you know, do we really choose that path because like we weigh the options and choose that path, or is it because, you know, God set up experiences to lead us away from the other ones to that one? Right. Is that kind of what you're thinking?
That's kind of what I'm thinking, but yeah. I do get what you're saying, that it would undermine the idea of God as we have him portrayed in the Bible if he were to like set us up for something that's gone wrong. So what I understand you saying is that God gives us an option and we either choose it or not. And that's our free will.
Yeah.
Because we get to choose which one.
We get to choose to follow God, but we can also choose not to. One of the things that was like a cool verse for me that Albert pointed out the other day was everything is permissible, but not everything is beneficial. And how that speaks to our free will. That we have the choice to do anything that we want, and it can be even stuff that's against God. And God's not trying to impede on our free will by making us do anything. That's why it's permissible. Like, he's given us permission to choose things. But not everything that we do is going to be beneficial.
Yeah, like, I could just choose to become a cocaine addict right now. Obviously, God's like, probably shouldn't do that, because he knows deep down it's not going to benefit me in any way.
And,
but he's like, I'm giving you the free will to like, hey, if you want to go down that path, I'm not going to stop you because I'm giving you the choice. Like,
another thing that I've always liked too is there's a part where it talks about how everything that the enemy intended for evil, God can turn for good. So the things that happen that are really bad that we choose to like do that are awful to each other, like things that have happened in my life that have been like really bad, like not good things, and I can say that they were not good things, I can say that God, in the middle of the bad, in the middle of people who have chosen to go away from God's path and done damage to me, like God has used those things to bring total healing in my life. Out of like the crap and out of the pain. It's like, out of the bad stuff that people choose that isn't in God's will, God can still redeem it. And so it's not like God isn't any less of a big like thing. It's not like God can't like be a part of it. You know what I mean? Like,
no,
but God can redeem everything that people choose.
But do you, my thing is that I get exactly what you're saying. But my thing is that if God is indeed omnipotent, then he has the option to allow those things to happen or not to allow those things to happen. Is that right?
Allow those things to happen.
So I think so. If you're using that language, it's kind of interesting because what happens in this. It's kind of fun because it's hard to avoid these conversations when it comes to like this. If you look at late medieval Catholicism, you get something coming in called voluntarism. And what voluntarism is doing is it's this emphasis on God's power. And so instead of you can say that the tradition of the church before that was able to simultaneously say that God is all good and that what we understand is good is something that's true. We have senses of what is good and not good because of the image that he's built into us, such that to pursue is to have more of the good is, in a sense, it's almost like have more of what God is really is, you know, there. They're able to hold that together with sort of God's omnipotence, so all powerful. What you see in late medieval Catholicism, which is really problematic, and this is one of the things that the reformers are struggling with, and rightly so, what you see is this voluntarism, which is an emphasis on God's will, sort of God's will as being the sort of the thing that determines everything, in such a way that it is separated from God's goodness, because it's saying, well, goodness can't be something. Well, if you say that there's goodness, well then, and that God has to be good, God has to do what's good, well then you have then what you're doing is you're putting a category above God that God has to adhere to. No, that's not what God is. God's bigger than that. He can do whatever he wants. That's sort of the way that the argument goes. And this is what Luther and Calvin, and you see it more in Calvin. This is what Calvin, you know, sort of inherits. And so he inherits a framework in which he's used to already thinking about there being a difference between what's good and God's will. And for him, it comes down to God's will. That's really the thing. It's like, no, God is omnipotent. He is all powerful. He can do whatever he wants. It just does not matter a lick if it resonates with what seems right in our categories of right and wrong. This doesn't factor in at all. God is not bound by anything. His will is the one sort of, it's kind of the, if you look in his theology, this is the one fundamental thing that comes down to. It's the hidden will of God. That's what everything's about. In the end of the day, you have, on one hand, you have the revealed will of God, which is God might say, hey, I want this person to be saved for that. But really, his hidden will is this thing. And it's the hidden will of God that's going to determine everything. And our categories, right, wrong, good, bad, they just don't matter. They might be helpful to a degree, but in the end, it's God's will that's going to be fundamental. I think that both where Luther and Calvin go with that, and the people on the other side as well, so not just them. I think if you look at some of the late medieval Catholic theologians, this is something where I think both Protestants and Catholics go and look at this and be like, this sucked. Like, this period in late medieval history, there is some crappy theology was going around that needed to be condemned, and because it wasn't condemned, because it's not necessarily that it was like codified as orthodoxy, because it wasn't condemned the way that it should have been, it allowed things to get out of hand, both in the church itself, and then when you get to the Reformation, things that come out of that, and some of the gnarly theological things that we don't know quite what to do with. The tradition before that is pretty unified. When I say pretty unified, I don't know any exceptions to this, in saying that both God's goodness and God's will are held together. They're held together in his person. In his person. So everything, there's no disjunction there. There's no omnipotence on one side and omni goodness on the other. And they're sort of warring issues. Like, these are fundamentally held in unity, and the senses that we have, any senses of that, they're just derived from the being of God. Which I think is a much more helpful way of looking at it. I think if you don't hold something like that, then I just think that it's really difficult to hold parts of scripture together. And so I think that seeing a division that's there, and sort of God's omnipotence and dividing that from his goodness is something where you can identify, you can trace through where that comes from, and it's something that we still wrestle with today. What I would assert is that even that division is something where I think that there's an assumption that's underlying that I think is faulty, and that those things can be divided from one another. Does it make some sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Makes sense.
There's also one other, but I just want to say, by the way, I think that both, I mean, what all three of you guys are saying, I think that it's evidence, like, kind of what's happening here is something that's happened for 2,000 years, as far as how exactly do you hold these together, because you have this really important truth on this side, this really important truth on this side, how do you hold them together? And I think that what orthodoxy does, if you're looking kind of throughout the history of the church, what orthodoxy does, by and large, isn't to go through and to say, hey, we're going to go and put in terms that humans can understand exactly how this works. And so God does this thing over here, we do this thing over here, this thing over here, this thing. Because what that does is that puts God into a piece of the equation, saying you can put it down there. And it's also saying that we can understand these things with our finite minds, which we could if God was something that we made up. If this is something that, like, we're actually making this whole thing up, we could probably do it in a way, we could put it all on paper and it would make perfect sense. But if God is actually bigger than us, and we only have a very, 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 like, if you want to look at the relationship between, like, an ant and an elephant, it's somewhat like that. But, again, you have to put, like, times the power of infinity with regards to our size and our ability to understand, you know, in relation to God's. And so, what Orthodox, if you look at the creeds of the church throughout history, what it's sought to do is to preserve the mystery. It's sought to say, okay, this over here, you can't say this over here. This over here, you can't say this over here. You can't fall off on either side. You have to affirm both of those things. But as you get farther and farther into this, you see there's just mystery. It's we have difficulty trying to figure out. And we can go through and explore that, and I think it's fruitful. And I think there are fruitful ways to do it. But at the end of the day, it's something where there's going to be tension in your mind trying to go and say, how the heck do these things hold together? Because if we're getting in a conversation, we're talking about what is it like to be outside of time? What is it like to, you know, how does decision making work when you're outside of time? Well, we have no framework for that. Because it's like us saying, man, I wonder what it would be like to be able to breathe underwater and to be a fish. It's like if we can't do that with a fish, if we're not able to do that with something that is kind of on the evolutionary food chain, if it's something that's lower than us, how the heck are we supposed to do the thing that's greater than us? We don't have a capacity for it. So there's, I don't know. I think if we get to a spot where you're like, wow, this just seems like it's a mystery, sort of at that point I would say, I think you're exactly right. And I think that that's kind of what the church throughout history has affirmed, that there's a mystery here, and that there's a challenge of holding together both pieces of it. Other thing I was going to say, then we can jump to something else, is there's an analogy that my New Testament professor gave with regards to predestination. He says that if this isn't helpful for you, drop it. I think it's a decent analogy. He says the way he understands predestination is that imagine that you're at an airport. There's a flight that's going from Vancouver to Toronto. The flight is predestined. It's going whether or not you're on that flight. This is the destination it's going to. The destination, it's been preset. It's going to Toronto. And so you can get on that flight, or you can not get on the flight, but this has been predestined. If that's helpful, I'll grab it. If it's not helpful, you can check it. Makes sense? It's kind of sort of the way he approaches it. So, yeah, I don't know where the heck we are. I don't know where the heck we are. But it's all, honestly, I think that all of that stuff is really good stuff, and it's important stuff to flesh out. Because if not, I think that we can just... I think the tendency can be that just whatever we happen to hear before, just be like, oh, that must be what the Bible means. And I think if we open up ourselves to the broader history of the church, I think we'll often find there's spots in which it's just, we have things where it's like, oh, that's just what it means, that thing. And most Christians throughout history haven't held to anything close to that. Or maybe things that are close to it, but not particularly, not exactly what something's saying in a certain area. And it's important to engage with that. Do you guys want to keep going in this?
Yeah, dude.
Okay. You guys feel free to stop at any point. Anyway, the way that I know that where we got in that is saying that's kind of the old perspective on Paul, the sort of kind of the there's almost a traditional faith works paradigm. That's where, which is the old perspective on Paul. Do those two perspectives make sense to you? Sort of the new perspective and the old perspective.
Yeah.
Okay. If you guys have questions on either of those as we're going along, totally feel free to ask them. So I think we're on verse 10. So, for now, men I persuade, or the God. I'll say it anyway. Or, am I seeking?